Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Later in today's program, Community Voices producer Jocelyn Robinson with WISO's new series, Rediscovered Radio. And Bill Felker returns with Poor Will's Miami Valley Almanac. Up first, a series of reports from WISO's Lewis Wallace. First, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel announced some details about the proposed military budget to be released by President Barack Obama next week. The Air Force and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base could see some major changes in the coming years.
The overall military budget isn't so much facing cuts as the potential for slower growth. Hagel's request for 2015 is expected to be around $500 billion, and he does want that number to keep ramping up, just more gradually than it has been. What that would mean for the Air Force is a reorganization of the fleet. A-10s, also known as Warthogs, and U-2 fighter jets could be retired for good in favor of smaller numbers of high-tech planes and drones. The secretary also says compensation will take a hit and recommends new limitations on commissary subsidies and housing assistance. Finally, Hagel is pushing hard for a BRAC, that's Base Realignment and Closure, in 2017, an idea Congress has resisted in recent years. Wright-Patt made out well in the last BRAC, but a new one would mean a new fight to keep Air Force activity in the state.
Also this week, Lewis took a look at the Dayton Metro Library expansion. The library begins construction this spring on the first part of a major reorganization, starting with the E.C. Doran branch in Old North Dayton.
Neighborhoods all over Dayton will see smaller, older branches close or get renovated, and some big new libraries open up in the next few years. That's partly because the Metro Library System wants more room for computer labs and meeting spaces as opposed to, well, books. But book lovers don't freak out, says Library Director Tim Cambich.
We see this not as an abandonment of the printed material, but we do also recognize that there are new technologies and new ways in which people consume information.
He says more and more people come to the library to use computers, get instruction or help, or check out e-books.
We certainly don't want to become obsolete.
The plan, which is supposed to be completed by 2017, is funded by a $187 million bond passed by voters in 2012. Construction at E.C. Doran could begin within a couple of weeks. Miami Township, Northwest Dayton, and the main library come next. Lewis Wallace, WYSO.
And Lewis will be back later in the program with our series Under Construction. Ohio Secretary of State John Husted announced early voting hours throughout the state for the coming May and November elections. The matter of voting hours has caused flare-ups among elections officials and legislators in the past. In an interview with WYSO, Husted says he simply enacted a bipartisan proposal from the Ohio Association of Elected Officials and only after legislators had refused to act.
I've asked the General Assembly to pass a schedule for early voting that would be fair and uniform across the state. But what has happened is that they have not taken that responsibility up. They did not pass any legislation that would set a uniform and fair schedule across the state. So I did the next best thing. I used the authority that I have under law to implement a proposal that Democrats and Republicans put together at the local level. The Ohio Association of Elections Officials, which is made up of Democrat and Republicans across the state that run elections, came up with a fair and uniform set of hours and days that they would like to see early voting occur over the 29-day early voting period. And what I did today is issue a directive putting that in place in all 88 counties so that all voters will be treated the same across the state, that they will all be treated fairly and equitably, and that we can put aside some of the controversies that occurred in the past over that schedule of early voting. And that will be in addition to the fact that every single voter will receive an absentee ballot request mailed to their home. So in Ohio, if you fill that out and send it in, you'll have 4 weeks to vote without ever leaving home.
This is actually being portrayed by some groups as a limitation of voter rights. Why are there so many challenges to getting these voting rules set?
Well, frankly, there are some people that are never happy. And the bottom line is, for me, what I'm trying to do is find things that I can get bipartisan agreement on. You're never going to make 100% of the people happy, but if I can talk to local party chairmen of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and they say, hey, this is a fair schedule, it seems to me like most people should be satisfied with it across the political spectrum. I've not run into a single voter who was denied the opportunity to vote because over that early voting period, I've asked for people to give me a bipartisan schedule. That's what they did. And that's what I'm implementing. It's pretty easy to vote here in Ohio, and we have one simple goal in mind. We want to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat so that people have access to the polls, but at the same time feel confidence in the integrity of the elections. And what we're trying to do is to do our best to accommodate all of the different voices out there and to put a proposal together that Democrats and Republicans can agree upon, and what we have is just that.
And in that line, it looks like some members of the OAEO are speaking out, saying that while they may not necessarily be satisfied with everything in this, it is a compromise and it is the best thing moving forward.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not something that I took to them. It's something that they brought to me. I commend them on their efforts to work across party lines to come up with a schedule that they could all buy into so that we can move past some of the controversies of the past and focus on the more important issues that are affecting the education and the economy of the state of Ohio.
I guess in closing, what do you say is your answer to the charge that this is limiting voter rights?
Well, you have 4 weeks to vote without ever leaving home in Ohio. If you want to vote today, if you're hearing this story on the radio, you can fill out an absentee ballot request today. Send that in, and your ballot will come to you 29 days before the election. You never have to leave home to cast your ballot. We've made it very easy to vote in Ohio, and we have one of the best systems in the country.
Ohio Secretary of State John Husted. Several protests were held after Husted announced the early voting hours and after Governor John Kasich signed two bills into law, one that also shortens early voting hours and another that prohibits county boards of elections from mailing out absentee ballots on their own. Voters can still request absentee ballots at any time before the election deadline. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up next, reporter Lewis Wallace returns with Under Construction.
Welcome to Under Construction, WISO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area. I'm Lewis Wallace. This week, we're going back to West Dayton and Trotwood, where people have seen all kinds of businesses boarded up, from banks to grocery stores to Best Buys. Catherine Crosby is head of the Dayton Human Relations Council, and she says the West Side is seeing a perfect storm of increasing poverty, population loss, low wages, and property values that have crashed since the recession.
When you mix all of that together, you know, a high concentration of poverty, which means that you have less disposable income, which means that you have less income to purchase products, that means that the businesses begin to surface. And so it's just a really nice mix of disinvestment for a community. And then to add to it, you have the foreclosure, which means that you have vacant properties, which means you have a reduction in residents. The other challenge is that, you know, Dayton is a city of small businesses. Our success from an economic development standpoint is going to be based on our small business development. We're not a city that's going to attract Fortune 500 companies. So helping people to understand that when you go to support some of these larger chains versus the small businesses that are in your community, you further strain our ability to impact the community in a positive way from an economic standpoint.
And what more do you think can be done in West Dayton and in Trotwood to support small business growth?
Well, I think definitely one of the things that we have to do is to help the consumers or the residents in those communities understand how important it is to support businesses that are located there, particularly small businesses.
And it seems like there's kind of a downward spiral effect, which has been a discussion recently on a national level. There's been a lot of talk about economic mobility and the growing lack of economic mobility. Right. Do you think that economic immobility is growing in Dayton?
I think that, you know, Dayton is the largest city in the county. We have a higher concentration, I think, of poverty in our community. And so I definitely think that that's a challenge. It's no secret that we also suffer from a brain drain. So while we have a large number of colleges in the area, we have a hard time retaining those students. And so we've made a huge investment in trying to figure out how do we retain college graduates. So if we're not able to retain those individuals that have the potential for higher income, then yes, it does challenge our economic mobility.
And you at the Human Relations Council also work on specifically issues of discrimination mm-hmm. and also supporting minority businesses. Right. What are some examples of how you see discrimination playing out and affecting or interacting with that question of economic mobility?
I think one of the things that happens, you know, and some will label it discrimination, but I definitely think there's some disadvantage. There's a network of individuals that are comfortable with working with certain businesses, and sometimes that means that our minority businesses or our female businesses may not have access to that. We've done a disparity study that shows that there has been discrimination in the marketplace when it comes to procurement opportunities or construction opportunities, and so that's why we've set up certification programs for disadvantaged businesses to make sure that there are opportunities available to them. One of the things that we do through our Minority Business Assistance Center is help to build the capacity of those centers, but the other thing, or those businesses, but the other thing that we also do is that when we have larger scale projects that are happening in the community, like the Racino Project, like the Dayton Metro Library Project, what we try to do is we try to encourage the owners of those projects to work with disadvantaged businesses to increase their economic opportunity, and that eventually it will help the economic base in the Dayton community. The saying goes that you're only as strong as your weakest link. So if we're not developing all of our businesses, if we're not supporting all of our community, then the entire community suffers.
That's Catherine Crosby with the Dayton Human Relations Council, a city project that works for harmony and equal opportunity across Dayton. The Human Relations Council is working with minority and women companies on access to contracts for the Dayton Metro Library rebuilding and the new Racino under construction on Wagner Ford Road. And this is Under Construction, WISO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area. We dig underneath the physical and economic markers of growth to look at the human consequences. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
Meet us at the club this week on American Roots as we dance to two great American musics, Go-Go and Zydeco. From the nation's capital, we'll visit with the man they call the godfather of Go-Go, Chuck Brown. And then we're down home in Louisiana for Zydeco accordionist and fiddler Jeffrey Broussard. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up this afternoon at 2, where else but WISO?
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by contributing listeners. And there's never been a better time to contribute to WISO than right now. All gifts received before midnight on March 2nd make you eligible to win a pair of season tickets to Victoria Theatre Association's Premier Health Broadway series next year. That's 6 Broadway shows. You don't have to contribute to be entered, but we hope you will. Donate online, mail in a check, or drop it off in person. Information is at wyso.org. Thank you.
Uno, two, three, four.
This past week, WYSO launched an exciting new series of stories called Rediscovered Radio. Here's General Manager Nina Ellis with some background on the series.
5 years ago, here at WYSO, we found a room full of old and dusty audio tapes in a moldy basement room. They contained programs going back to WYSO's first broadcast in 1958. With a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and help from the Greene County Public Library, we began to catalog and digitize more than 200 hours of those tapes, and today we begin to share them with you. All this year, we'll focus on the 1960s and 1970s to show how we lived and how the country was changing. Here now is Jocelyn Robinson, a WYSO Community Voices producer, and our first ever Archives Fellow with Rediscovered Radio, historic audio from the WYSO Archives.
WYSO Radio News.
It's 1963, morning edition, all things considered, and public radio as we know it won't exist for another 8 years. Yet WYSO was covering local events with an ear to their national importance. You just heard the start of a special report by Antioch student Bruce Havens on efforts to integrate a white-owned barbershop that wouldn't serve black customers.
Much is at stake in this local barbershop controversy, not only for the barber and civil rights partisans, but for the citizens of Ohio and perhaps the entire nation. Many court cases have stemmed from the battle at Gegner's barbershop, but the case with the broadest legal implications concerns Barber Lewis Gegner, a Yellow Springs Negro, Paul Graham, and the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. At stake, the constitutionality of the barbershop sections of the state's major anti-discrimination legislation, the Ohio Public Accommodations Act.
Within months, a major protest closed the barbershop, and the lawsuits evaporated. But Ohio was changing, just like the rest of the country. President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in July of 64 and came to town a couple years later on the midterm campaign trail. WYSO was there.
Listen now as WYSO takes you, by recording, to the Montgomery County Fairgrounds in Dayton, Ohio, for this afternoon's address by President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Here is the President of the United States.
On this Labor Day weekend, I have sought the best relaxation that a president can get. By folding away your Washington newspapers, leaving the Capitol, and coming out and visiting with his friends and his countrymen. I have traveled to the beautiful state of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and now beautiful Ohio. I have talked about the problems of the people.
President Johnson's ambitious social agenda was overshadowed as the Vietnam War escalated. With the emergence of the anti-war and black power movements, speakers came to Antioch's campus to encourage people to critique their government.
On tonight's community lecture series, we present SNCC in Retrospect. The speaker is Cleveland Sellers, past field secretary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
I guess we can start off by examining the Great Society, which considers itself to be inclusive while really being exclusive.
By the early 1970s, protests were taking place all over the U.S. Listen to a student reporter tell us about a demonstration right here in the Miami Valley.
This is Julia Reichert for WYSO News down at the Dayton Convention Center, where tonight Howard Robard Hughes will be inducted into Dayton's Aviation Hall of Fame. As I stand here inside the building, I notice a group of demonstrators are beginning to gather outside carrying signs. The demonstration seems to have been called by the New American Movement to protest against a number of different issues. Some of the people are saying dump Nixon. Some of the people are saying end corporate control of the government. Some of the signs relate to the continuation of the war in Vietnam. So this is obviously a multi-issue demonstration.
Of course, there was lots of amazing music broadcast in those early years that's in the archives, too. Here's Pete Seeger in 1969 with a message that's still timely today.
The world's got hunger and ignorance. Bring 'em home, bring 'em. You can't beat that with bombs and guns.
That's just a taste of the hundreds of hours of historic recordings we have. Every few weeks we'll share more, so if you're interested in how the past affects the present and in turn the future, stay tuned. For Rediscovered Radio at WYSO, I'm Jocelyn Robinson.
Major support for Rediscovered Radio comes from the Ohio Humanities Council and the Greene County Public Library. To learn more about the WYSO archives and the historic audio you just heard, visit wyso.org.
Stay tuned for more Rediscovered Radio on WYSO in the months ahead. In an even earlier era, 70 years ago, the country was deep into World War II, and the U.S. was on the offensive in the air. WISO's aviation commentator Dan Patterson says that the big U.S. four-engine bombers were being shot down in shocking numbers.
Think about this. On one mission, we lost 60 bombers. That's 600 men. It was just too much. The U.S. needed a fighter plane with long legs, one that could go all the way deep into Germany and protect the bombers, essentially win the air war and provide the long-sought-after supremacy of the air. The German Luftwaffe, their air force, was now fighting over their own country, and they were ferocious in combat. They devised tactics which included firing rockets, dropping bombs onto the bombers, and flying at very high speed through the formations of large, slow airplanes, firing with machine guns and big cannons. The U.S. theory that the bombers would always get through was proven wrong, and for a time the Army Air Force drew back. They needed help, and help was on the way. It was the P-51 Mustang. Everyone was betting on the Mustang. It was a combination of American and British industry. The ability to go the distance and dogfight at 25,000 feet required a truly allied effort. The best aircraft engine in the world was the British Rolls-Royce Merlin. It was married to the world's best fighter design provided by North American Aviation. In a 1942 test, it proved to be the essential fighter, the aircraft to defeat the Germans anywhere and at any altitude. There were growing pains, but American industry was by then running at full steam. The cobwebs and rust from the Great Depression had been pushed aside, and as President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had named it, the arsenal of democracy was in high gear. In late 1943, the P-51 Mustang arrived in England. They were transported on ships and then assembled by the Army Air Force mechanics. Slowly, too slow for the air crews, the Mustangs were deployed to the fighter squadrons. The training and orientation process was shortened as much as possible. Once the pilots learned how to fly their new fighter and take advantage of its superiority, operations began in February of 1944, 70 years ago, right now. The commanders had also rethought tactics and gave the fighter leaders much more freedom to pursue the Germans and take the war to them. The results were swift and they were sure. Bomber losses began to decline and American fighter pilots started adding up aerial victories. In late February, the bomber forces attacked the German aircraft industry relentlessly. In early March, they flew all the way to Berlin, with the escorting Mustangs able to go all the way to the target and back. Superiority of the air was also essential to be able to launch the invasion of Europe by the Allies under the command of General Eisenhower. Between February and late May, just before the invasion, the German fighter forces had taken a huge beating, and on D-Day, June 6, 1944, there were only a handful of attacks by German planes, and they were not very effective. While General Eisenhower was looking over the Normandy beaches late in June 1944 and asked if he had control of the air by a young Lieutenant John Eisenhower, Ike's son, the general responded, "If I didn't have air superiority, I wouldn't be here." For WISO, this is Dan Patterson wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of early spring. In the late 1970s, a research scientist named Mandel Brough looked at fluctuations in all kinds of phenomena, from the stock market to cloud formations. He came to the conclusion that these very different occurrences were related to one another as patterns, and that they revealed an underlying force that pervaded every aspect of life on Earth. In each of the events and things he studied, Mandel Brough found what he called self-similar systems, and he called these systems fractals. Picture a month or two of a graph of the Dow Jones averages. That's a fractal pattern. Mandel Brough asserted that fractals are showing us a life principle not unlike a yin-yang law that underlies not only weather and stocks and heartbeats, but almost everything from the shape of ferns and fjords to the filigree in lungs and leaves. Well, if fractals reflect some universal designing set in nature, and if they are in fact the signatures of nature, then what are we to make of them? During the Middle Ages, the doctrine of signatures held that the shape of any natural object, like a leaf or a root, held the key to its medicinal use. Modern fractal theory posits a not so dissimilar view, that patterns might not only hold the key to understanding the rhythm, but also the purpose and the meaning of phenomena. Some analysts believe that fractals could hold the secret of the universe, explain the ultimate causes not only of our personal decisions, but of the outside forces that influence them. So, in a way, all of the ups and downs of nature and of our lives are part of what Mandel Brough would call self-similar patterns. Do they have meaning? And what is their connection? This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of early spring. In the meantime, follow the ups and downs. Look for the patterns.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported WYSO. Coming up next, The Book Nook.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by contributing listeners. And there's never been a better time to contribute to WISO than right now. All gifts received before midnight on March 2nd make you eligible to win a pair of season tickets to Victoria Theatre Association's Premier Health Broadway series next year. That's six Broadway shows. You don't have to contribute to be entered, but we hope you will. Donate online, mail in a check, or drop it off in person. Information is at wyso.org. Thank you.
And the stones began landing faster and faster. And we just realized that we were being stoned by children.
Join us for more of the world's best raconteurs next time on the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Coming up tonight at 11, where else but WISO?